Coming up on Star Stuff, the solar spectacular that is a total eclipse of the sun. Climate change on planet Earth now starting to impact near space. And searching for Planet X. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
Aboriginal myths, tropical Australia and the Great Barrier Reef have provided a stunning backdrop to this week's total eclipse of the sun. For over 3 hours on Wednesday, the alignment of the sun, the moon and the earth created one of the most spectacular sights in nature. Our sun, the bringer of light and life on earth, was briefly blocked out, replaced by a corona of gold, its face obscured by a dark disk. Daytime stars appeared in an indigo sky. The temperature suddenly dropped eerily, and birds, confused by the sudden strange return of night, began to roost. A swathe of northern Australia, from Arnhem Land in the Northern Territory to Cairns and Port Douglas in North Queensland, had a ringside seat for the spectacle of eclipse before it moved out over the vast uninhabited South Pacific Ocean. The light show began at 6:35 local time, shortly after daybreak, as the moon's shadow, or umbra, fell on the tropical bushland of the Top End, about 250 kilometres east of Darwin. The path of totality then moved southeast, at about 1700 kilometres per hour, across the Gulf of Carpentaria and into Queensland, where eclipse junkies, some from Europe and the United States on special package tours, gathered in the resort towns of Cairns and Port Douglas to experience 2 minutes and 4 seconds of totality. Adelaide University astroblogger Dr. Ian Musgrave watched the event from Cairns.
I was up on a place called Yorkeys Knob, which is a little rise in northern Cairns suburbs. Had a fantastic view out of the sea. You could see the distant islands, and the sun came up beautifully and then almost immediately ran into a band of cloud. You could get glimpses of the sun through the cloud occasionally. You could see the growing chip become bigger and bigger and bigger until you had a crescent sun. But the critical period of time of totality was covered in cloud. However, what we saw, all of a sudden it was like a switch and the sky went dark. And you could see there'd been patches of sunlight sitting on the water, and they switched off. And so everything went dark, and it was incredible. There's this feeling of nighttime during the day.
Did it get cold?
It definitely got cold. You could feel the chill, and then everyone behind me just sort of erupted as soon as the light went out, just before the end of totality, where the sunlight was coming towards the edge of the cloud. And you could see this little rainbow of colour around the edge of the cloud. And then all of a sudden, the sun came out, and you could see this very thin, like it was like a piece of wire that was the sun coming out from behind the moon. And that was amazing. That was really amazing.
That's Dr. Ian Musgrave from the University of Adelaide. Crowds at Mareeba had a better view of the event.
That's just absolutely amazing. To see that black hole in the sky with the stars out, it's just absolutely awe-inspiring. The corona is very, very clear. Few of the valleys of the moon showing out from the edge there.
It's like a round mirror, black. Spectacular.
This is our sixth or seventh eclipse now. We've had a fantastic opportunity because we've got a holiday in Australia and we've got an eclipse as a bonus. It was brilliant. It was spectacular.
It was really quite spectacular. And as it reached its maximum, we got that really weird sort of light. It didn't go dark. It was really quite different. It was all the light was subdued, but not like around a sunrise where it's just all yellow and oranges. It was really quite different.
After a 14,500-kilometre trek across the globe, the three-body ballet came to an end 3 hours and 13 minutes after it began, and about 800 kilometres west of Chile. Outside the path of totality, a partial eclipse was visible in Papua New Guinea, the extreme eastern part of Indonesia, the eastern half of Australia, the whole of New Zealand, as well as Polynesia, part of Antarctica, and the southern part of Chile and Argentina. Dwayne Hamacher, an expert in Aboriginal astronomy from the University of New South Wales, says eclipses have always played an important role in traditional Aboriginal cultures. The moon is often seen as a man, the sun as a woman, and the pair chase each other across the sky, sometimes fighting, sometimes making love. The sun woman constantly pursues the moon man, who has rejected her advances. Sometimes she eclipses him, trying to kill him in a jealous rage. However, the spirits that hold up the sky intervene and drive her away. The people of Elko Island in Arnhem Land have a similar but less malevolent Dreamtime story. In their culture, a solar eclipse is an act of copulation between the sun woman and the moon man. As in other parts of the world, eclipses in Aboriginal communities were seen as a sign of impending calamity or black magic, a threat that could be addressed by medicine men who would chant specific sets of words or throw sacred stones or a boomerang at the eclipsing sun. Modern-day science has a less romantic view of the solar eclipse. Astronomers know it happens because of a remarkable celestial coincidence. The sun is 400 times wider than the moon, but it's also 400 times further away. That symmetry means when the moon is in exactly the right line between the sun and the earth and at exactly the right distance, it can completely obscure the solar face for those who are in its shadow or umbra. For those positioned outside the roughly 150-kilometre wide central path, the path of totality, but who are still partially in the moon's shadow, the penumbra, the eclipse is partial, looking like a bite's being taken out of the sun. Total eclipses are rare, occurring over a given point on the Earth's surface only about once every 410 years in the Northern Hemisphere, but only once every 540 years in the Southern Hemisphere. You can blame orbital mechanics for that. The last total eclipse was on July the 11th, 2010. Again, that was over the South Pacific. And the next won't take place until March the 20th, 2015, occurring over Iceland, the Faroe Islands, and the far north of Norway. As for Australia, we can expect a partial eclipse next May, and again, Northern Australia is the place to be. The next total eclipse of the sun won't happen down under until the 22nd of July 2028, but it will be very cool, travelling southeast from the Western Australian Kimberley through the Central Northern Territory and southwestern Queensland before bisecting New South Wales, including passing directly over the heart of Sydney at about 1600 local time and ending on the tip of southern New Zealand. Well, it appears global warming on planet Earth is now starting to impact space. A new study has found carbon dioxide levels are increasing much faster than expected in the upper atmosphere. The research, reported in the journal Nature Geoscience, helps explain why the upper atmosphere has contracted, in the process reducing orbital decay rates, which keep dangerous space junk in orbit longer, allowing more of it to accumulate. The good news is it also keeps operational satellites and the International Space Station in orbit longer between boosts as well. The paper's lead author, Dr. John Emmett from the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C., found both carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide were reaching concentrations of about 200 parts per million in the thermosphere at altitudes above 100 kilometres. Emmett says there's a very clear increase of over 23.5 parts per million per decade. That's almost a third more than predicted by previous upper atmospheric models. Now, in comparison, tropospheric carbon dioxide concentrations, those measured down near the Earth's surface, are increasing at a rate of about 20 parts per million every decade, with current levels near the ground at around 390 parts per million and growing. It's the first direct evidence that carbon dioxide is definitely increasing in the thermosphere. Previously, Emmett only had indirect clues from the decrease in satellite drag, with increases in carbon dioxide the suspected primary culprit. In the lower atmosphere, carbon dioxide acts as an insulating blanket, preventing heat from the surface escaping. It's the greenhouse effect. However, in the upper atmosphere, carbon dioxide radiates thermal energy back into space, causing an overall loss of heat. That makes CO2 the primary cooling agent in the thermosphere, shedding heat absorbed from the sun. And like anything cooler, it contracts. So the upper atmosphere shrinks, reducing the drag on spacecraft, meaning they'll take longer for their orbits to decay. Now that's good news if you're an operational satellite or the International Space Station. It extends your life because you need to use less valuable fuel in order to boost your orbit to a higher altitude again. But because atmospheric drag's the only method we have right now for removing orbital debris, less atmospheric drag means space junk will stay up there longer and it will continue to accumulate, becoming an even greater problem. To reach their conclusions, Emmett and colleagues used data gathered by the Canadian Space Agency's Atmospheric Chemistry Experiment, or ACE, a satellite which measures the temperature, pressure and density of atmospheric chemicals at different altitudes. They examined changes in carbon dioxide concentrations at altitudes up to 110 kilometres between 2004 and 2012. Prior to this study, carbon dioxide concentrations had only been measured to altitudes of about 35 kilometres. They speculate the larger-than-expected upper atmospheric trend may be caused by changes in the upper atmospheric circulation and increased mixing. According to Emmett, previous studies had already shown changes in temperature in the atmosphere were a direct result of overall climate change.
Well, I've noticed that the concentration of CO2 in the highest part of the atmosphere is increasing at a similar rate that it is in the lower atmosphere. This is expected because the changes in the lower atmosphere percolate up to the higher altitudes, but this is the first time we've ever directly detected this increase.
Did that come as a shock?
A little bit, yeah. We were expecting to see something more in line with what the models had predicted. But the models, the simulations that have been done to date have been fairly simple. They just use these global average models rather than taking into account the three-dimensional circulation of the atmosphere. And so we think that might be why it's bigger than we expected.
In the lower atmosphere, carbon dioxide acts as a greenhouse effect. It keeps heat in. It provides a blanket covering. What does it do in the upper atmosphere? What happens up there?
The same properties of CO2 are in effect up there. You know, it's a very efficient emitter of infrared radiation or heat. The difference is the air is so thin up there, and including the CO2 is so thin, it's actually transparent to the infrared radiation. In the contrast to the lower atmosphere, where CO2 is relatively thick and absorbs almost all of it that comes at it. And so it essentially acts as a heat sink. You know, the energy, thermal energy from other atoms is transferred to CO2 via collisions, and CO2 radiates the infrared energy, which then escapes to space. And so you have a net loss of heat. And it turns out that CO2 is actually the primary cooling agent of the thermosphere. It's the main thing that the current thermosphere uses to shed the heat that it absorbs from the sun. Just like any column of air, if it gets cooler, it shrinks because the atoms get closer together. And what this means is that at a given altitude, you'll expect to see a smaller density, overall density of the atmosphere.
And when that happens, what happens to things up there like satellites or space junk or the International Space Station?
Well, yeah, the lower density then reduces the drag on these objects. It takes longer for their orbits to decay and to re-enter the atmosphere. There's some studies ongoing to determine, you know, how this effect might affect the long-term population of debris. But certainly, yeah, it will take longer for the debris to come in.
Tell us a little bit about how you went about the research using ACE.
Look through the atmosphere at the sun, and from the, you know, we know what the sun spectrum is because the instrument will take a spectrum of the sun with all the emission lines and absorption lines of the sun's atmosphere. And then when it looks at the sun through the Earth's atmosphere, it gets additional absorption lines from the Earth's atmosphere. And that pattern of absorption lines or the spectrum tells us what the densities of CO2 and also a lot of other species are.
When it looks at the sun looking through, I guess the technical term is the limb of the Earth.
Right.
How much is it seeing? Is it seeing the whole atmospheric column? Is it from the ground up to right up into the ionosphere?
It measures the temperature and the pressure and the density of all these molecules from about 5 kilometers to about 140 kilometers. And the CO2 measurements go up to about 110 kilometers altitude. So yeah, it covers the whole range of the atmosphere. The primary mission of it was to look at the troposphere and also the stratosphere. This is sort of a side benefit of being able to get the CO2 very high up.
Can't be put down to things like increased use of space by rockets going up there?
Yeah, we looked into that because, you know, the space traffic, you know, the exhaust from rockets, you know, that's right around the area where they do the upper stages, will burn in a rocket. And that does inject additional CO2 in the atmosphere. But, you know, that's been a fairly constant process, and the total amount of carbon in that can't explain this excess that we observe in the trends.
And that sort of leaves you with few options other than it's coming up from below.
Right. And normally, you know, the concentration falls off above a certain altitude, above about 60 kilometers, because CO2 gets broken down by the sun's ultraviolet rays, and so the CO2 itself starts to decrease. But if there's some sort of dynamics that's drawing up the stuff from below further up to keep it populated, then that might help explain why we're seeing this larger trend.
Any naturally occurring dynamics that could be doing that extra mixing?
There are a couple of studies that indicate the change in temperature in the middle atmosphere as a result of overall climate change. We expect to see actually an increase in some of the dynamics there that might, and that could possibly explain why the CO2 might be being drawn up like that.
This is not something the Hadley cycle could be involved in because that's too low, isn't it? That's in the troposphere.
Right.
Was there a difference at different latitudes?
We weren't able to resolve so much the latitude dependence of these trends because we're only observing, we only get observations on the limb of the Earth, so near, you know, when, where the sun is behind the limb. So it's basically only sunrise and sunset. And so we can't really get good samples to get an accurate enough trend to resolve the latitude difference. It seems to be fairly uniform with latitude.
And it couldn't be related to tidal temperatures or anything like that from day to night side?
No, when we look at the sunrise cases versus the sunset cases, we get essentially the same trend.
When you saw all this and it was all coming together, how did it make you and your team feel?
Oh, well, we were very, very excited, you know, to find some direct evidence of these CO2 increases. You know, I've been studying trends in the thermospheric density for several years using satellite drag observation. You know, we've seen a decrease in the satellite drag, and suspected primary culprit of that is CO2 increases. But that's indirect evidence. It's the first direct evidence that we have that CO2 is definitely increasing, and it's pretty straightforward that that's going to decrease the temperatures in the thermosphere and therefore the densities at a given altitude.
That's Dr. John Emmett from the United States Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C. A report in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics claims a newly discovered planet seven times bigger than Earth may be able to support life. The planet's been named HD40307G. It's located in the habitable zone of a K-class orange dwarf star 42 light-years away. The habitable zone is that region around a star where water can exist in a liquid state, an essential prerequisite for life as we know it. The so-called super-Earth orbits its host star HD40307 every 200 days. The previously discovered planets around this star are all hot super-Earths because they orbit too close to the star to support life. Astronomers describe the star as being slightly smaller and less luminous than the Sun. The next step will be to use powerful telescopes, both Earth and space-based, to study the planet more closely. So far, some 846 planets have been found outside our solar system since 1995. Most discoveries to date have been of planets far larger than the Earth. Meanwhile, recent discoveries of exoplanets are raising the question of whether astronomers have found all the planet-like objects in our own solar system. The recent announcement of the discovery of exoplanet Alpha Centauri BB is a testimony to how far planetary detection techniques have now come over the past few decades. While the number of confirmed exoplanets, planets beyond our solar system, keeps growing, the search for planets in our own solar system has subsided since those pioneering days at the end of the 18th century. They climax with the discovery of Uranus, and almost 100 years later, the identification of Neptune. The idea of another planet, dubbed Planet X, inspired astronomers to keep searching for yet another 100 years, in a hunt that was full of twists and turns. The hunt for Planet X began in earnest in 1781 when British astronomer Sir William Herschel was studying the stars of the constellation Taurus. He noticed one star seemed a little bit fuzzy or nebulous in appearance. A few days later, it seemed to have moved position. He concluded it must have been a comet. However, further study revealed it was actually a planet. Herschel had discovered the planet Uranus, the seventh planet in our solar system and the first to be discovered beyond the orbit of Saturn. Detailed observations of Uranus's movement revealed an orbit that seemed to be influenced by another, even more distant object. Mathematicians studying the data predicted the position of an eighth planet before it was officially discovered, first time that had occurred. Later, observations confirmed the existence of Neptune, exactly where the mathematicians had predicted it should be. Neptune's existence was formally announced in 1846. Now, using the same technique to study the orbital characteristics of both Uranus and Neptune, scientists revealed that both were still being tugged by the gravitational force of yet another unknown object. The search for a ninth planet was now underway. It was American astronomer Percival Lowell who identified several possible candidates. Some years after Lowell's death, in 1930, Pluto was identified by Clyde Tombaugh, an astronomer working at the Lowell Observatory. Pluto was believed to be the final member of the solar system's planetary family. That was, however, until 1978, when astronomers discovered Pluto's moon Charon, once again opening up the debate over Planet X. You see, through accurate measurements of Charon's orbit, the mass of Pluto could be deduced. Ultimately, it showed that the ninth planet couldn't possibly have affected the orbits of Neptune and Uranus, as observations appeared to show. Pluto, even with Charon added to it in a binary system, just didn't have enough mass. The renewed interest in Planet X was short-lived, however, as the Neptunian flyby of the Voyager 2 spacecraft in 1989 revealed that its mass was less than thought. Reapplying this knowledge to both the ice giants Uranus and Neptune showed the planets were actually behaving exactly as they should, and the orbital perturbations that were being detected by earlier observations were in fact in error. So, it would seem the myth of Planet X had finally died. Now, this could have been the end of the saga for Planet X, but recent studies of the Kuiper Belt, that region of icy minor planets, comets and debris located in the outer regions of the solar system beyond Neptune, suggest that this may in fact not be the case after all. All regular listeners to Star Stuff will know of the constant parade of newly discovered objects in the Kuiper Belt. Now, it would be reasonable to expect that the millions of frozen lumps of rock would gradually decrease with distance from the Sun. The problem is, at a distance of about 48 astronomical units, that's 48 times the Earth-Sun distance, and beyond the average orbit of Pluto, Kuiper Belt objects seem to suddenly drop off in what scientists have now termed the Kuiper Cliff. One theory is that maybe there is a Planet X out there somewhere, which is responsible for the strange and unexpected outer edge of the solar system. Or maybe not. After all, the Voyager and Pioneer spacecraft, which are heading out of the solar system, haven't detected any substantial planets that might cause the Kuiper Cliff. Still, space is a big place. The chances of any spacecraft just happening to fly past a previously undiscovered planet are highly unlikely. On the other hand, observations using both ground-based and space-based telescopes have turned up little new evidence, although they have discovered a couple of extra moons for Pluto. The count is now 5. But the thing is, the jury is still out. Until an answer is found for the Kuiper Cliff, the ghost of Planet X will remain as a tantalizing, if somewhat unlikely, possible explanation. We'll keep you informed. Geologists in Poland have unearthed the largest meteorite ever found in Eastern Europe. Meteorite hunters found the 300-kilogram cone-shaped 2-meter-wide hunk of iron late last month, 2 meters below the surface, in a reserve just north of Poznan in western Poland. Scientists are hoping the rare find will provide fresh clues about the composition of the Earth's interior. See, scientists know the Earth's core is composed of iron and nickel, but it remains tantalizingly inaccessible. So here they have this rock from space. It's similar in structure to the Earth's core, and it can be easily examined. The meteorite was discovered with a device used to detect electromagnetic anomalies in the Earth's surface, a sort of glorified metal detector. Geologists believe the meteor is composed of mostly iron with traces of nickel, just like the Earth's core. It crashed into what is now the Morasco Meteorite Reserve about 5,000 years ago. The reserve boasts 7 craters, the largest nearly 100 meters in diameter and 11 meters deep. So far, the reserve's provided some 1,500 kilograms of smaller meteorites. And as you'd expect, following the new discovery, scientists plan to broaden their hunt for meteorites in the region. Well, it seems Earth's rotational axis has shifted backwards and forwards over the past few billion years, and scientists finally think they know why. A report in the journal Nature suggests the phenomenon, known as oscillatory true polar wonder, happens because of a combination of convection pulses in the Earth's mantle and the elastic movements of the planet's outer shell, the lithosphere. Scientists examining paleomagnetic signatures in ancient rocks have identified at least 5 occasions in the past 2 billion years where the entire Earth seems to have tipped over by as much as 22 degrees compared to its rotational axis. However, the process is complicated because the data first needs to be disentangled from changes caused by things like continental drift. Now, let's be clear, the process we're talking about is different from precession, which happens as the planet's rotational axis wobbles like a spinning top. It's also different from that gradual movement of the Earth's magnetic poles, which is caused by the rotation of fluids in the Earth's outer core. Scientists say oscillatory true polar wonder is purely caused by the movement of mass inside the Earth through the convection of materials of different compositions, densities and temperatures in the Earth's mantle. You see, over time, the distribution of mass within the Earth changes, causing the entire planet to occasionally, well, tip. Lead author of the new research, Dr. Jessica Kreveling from Harvard University in Massachusetts, says that during these Earth-tipping events, the planet's rotational axis doesn't change in relation to the ecliptic, the Earth's orbital plane around the Sun. But the planet itself tips or rolls over slightly, and then, miraculously, rights itself again. Kreveling and colleagues used computer simulations to recreate the tipping events in order to try and establish why the Earth tips back again after one of these events. They found two separate mechanisms were responsible for the planet returning to its original orientation. See, the Earth's not a perfect sphere. An equatorial bulge caused by the planet's spin means its equatorial radius is 24 kilometers larger than its polar radius. This equatorial bulge acts as a stabilizer, righting the planet again after it tips, very much like one of those punching clowns. But Kreveling and colleagues also found that Earth tipping causes the planet's entire tectonic plate system and lithosphere to deform like a rubber band. And just like a rubber band that's been stretched, those plates want to snap back together to their original location and size. The researchers also found that these tipping events were more likely to occur when there was a supercontinent in place and few tectonic plates. In fact, the last time this occurred was when the supercontinent Pangaea was in existence between 250 and 150 million years ago. At that time, the entire planet tipped by 22 degrees, followed by another smaller tip of 8 degrees between 150 and 100 million years ago. Kreveling says, when the tipping occurred during a time of supercontinent configuration, the sort of stresses that accumulated within that unusually large tectonic plate would want to relax again, just like a rubber band, in the process helping the entire planet to right itself again.
What we were trying to do is understand a phenomenon that's known as a true polar wonder. That's defined as the movement of the entire solid Earth with respect to the rotation axis. By that, I mean you would... If you were a person hovering in outer space, you would observe the rotation axis stay the same and the Earth sort of tip over and then tip back up again. And a number of geologists before us have looked in the rock record and they think that they've found evidence for a number of these tip over events throughout Earth history. And so what we were asking is not why the Earth tipped over. We think that as a field we've sort of known that for the last couple of decades, but we were asking why it tips back up, because that's a very confusing sort of physics. And so we were excited to explain that, because for decades people have said there's no coming back if the Earth were to undergo these tipping. I guess one way to think about it is to sort of think of just a globe spinning, and if you put your hand on it, it's going to kind of sort of temperate latitudes. That's going to sort of want to tilt that Earth towards a more stable position, putting the mass sort of near the equator.
So where does the mass go to allow it to return to its original, to pop back, as you say? That's the mystery,
well,
isn't it?
Well, actually, we think that it's the mass that's the driving force for tipping, but it's actually two separate mechanisms that we think allow for the tip back. First, one has to do with what's called the Earth's equatorial bulge. And it's that extra bulge or fatness that we think acts to stabilize the Earth's rotation. You can think of this a little bit like the weight at the bottom of one of those toy plastic punching bags that you put on a table, right?
Yep.
So there's a weight in the bottom, and it acts to basically spring that punching bag back into vertical once it's punched sideways. And in this way, that sort of excess girth around Earth's equator acts as that same self-righting mechanism for Earth's rotation. And I should also say that we treat equally in the paper a second mechanism that we think is capable of bringing the pole back to its original position, and that has to do with strength of the tectonic plates. It turns out that if the pole moves on the Earth's surface, if from outer space it looks like the Earth tips over, the plates on the Earth's surface will all get deformed just a little bit, kind of like a rubber band. And just like rubber bands that are stretched, those plates will want to sort of snap back to their original size. They'll want to become unstressed. And so we propose that it's this elastic sort of strength that may have played another role in sort of tipping back of the pole to its original position. We got a clue from this because these sort of tip over and back events seem to happen like when the Earth's continents are gathered as a supercontinent, happens periodically throughout Earth history. And so if this true polar wonder tipping occurred during a time of a supercontinental configuration, the sort of stresses accumulated within that unusually large plate would want to relax, just like our rubber band. And that, we think, is the second self-righting mechanism for Earth's rotation.
Now, you're talking about the Wilson cycle there, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what
every 400...
Named after Tuzo Wilson.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of this overarching, you know, hundreds of millions of years.
Every 400 million years or something,
tend,
I think.
Yeah, exactly, where plates tend to amalgamate and then disperse.
That's Dr. Jessica Kreveling from Harvard University in the United States. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the @ symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science.